What about transportation? Are you able to get to a provider's office? How far away from your home is that provider's office? These are things that can create barriers. Are there parks and playgrounds in your neighborhood? When we think about that wellness and that big picture of that whole person health, it's truly that opportunity to examine the opportunities for physical activity outside of the home. Do you live in a walkable community? Then there's things like education, and that looks at overall literacy as well as health literacy. And I'll pause there because when we think about HR and the opportunity to engage employees, help them understand their employee benefits is key. So we can look for the opportunity to find ways to get that information to our employees, but then also break down that information so they really understand the coverage that they have access to and how they can use that to help ensure, you know, access to the care that they need. So very, very important in terms of the role of HR departments.
Hello, everyone. This is Jolene May, your host for the DiverSeek podcast, where we talk with real people doing real work in the diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging space. If you want to explore what people are doing right, what positive impacts are happening, or even how positive changes can be done, you're in the right place. We welcome you to join us. Today, we have Bridget Hurd with us. Bridget is the Vice President of Inclusion and Diversity and Chief Diversity Officer at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. She is passionate about connecting people to the resources and information they need to be their very best and helping employees grow, connect, and learn about different cultures, communities, generations, work styles, and perspectives. Bridget has over 27 years of experience addressing and strategizing towards inclusion, diversity, health equity, community relations, and corporate social responsibility. She is also the recipient of the DentaQuest 2020 Health Equity Heroes Award, recognizing individuals working to achieve equity during the coronavirus, was recognized as a top 100 diversity officer by the National Diversity Council in 2021, and in 2023 as one of the Diversity Global Magazine's top 15 influential women in diversity, and as Crain's Detroit Business Notable Leader in Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Bridget has a welcoming and infectious personality and sees inclusion and diversity having a huge capacity to connect people where we share our stories and experiences to learn from one another. Lastly, Bridget enjoys watching British murder mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Midsommar Murders. Please note all statements made by Bridget during the podcast are solely her own and do not express the views or opinions of her employer. Here we are, Bridget. Thank you so much for coming, and I'm excited to host you.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited for this conversation, and thank you for the great introduction.
You're welcome. I mean, you deserve it. You really do. I mean, there was a lot of awards in there, and I just was like, okay, how am I going to say all these, but make it matter and make it flow? And I hope I did that, but anyways.
You definitely did, and it truly matters because I am very privileged to be in this role to serve the employees at our company, to serve our members, and to serve the community at large. And I think those awards are just an expression of my passion and my commitment and dedication. So thank you for sharing them.
Of course. I love how beautifully you put that, of sharing your passion, you know? And with that, I'm going to segue into our first question, because you kind of started it, is just, you know, tell us more about yourself and how you approach the work that you do.
Yes. Well, I actually have a very multifaceted background. I have worked in the healthcare industry nearly 30 years in different roles and capacities, everything from community relations, where I had the opportunity to engage with community residents and truly get to understand what their real healthcare needs are, what barriers that they face in accessing care that they need. Also, I've worked in a communications role in the healthcare industry, and that was important because it's identifying the best ways to connect people to the resources, to the information. How do I break down complex things and make it really understandable and relatable to everyday people? And in my current roles here at Blue Cross Blue Shield, where I'm employed, I've had the opportunity to engage in our corporate giving. That means building partnerships with a lot of nonprofit organizations, again, that are that link to the community. And in my current role, leading inclusion and diversity, it's an opportunity, as you've already said, to bring and connect our employees so we can really learn about one another, learn about real people, as I always say, and, you know, learn about the different communities, learn about all of the different cultures. And when I say all of them, all of them, learn about different generations and where the similarities are and where the differences are and how we begin to understand and value those things. So I guess the idea of connecting and communicating and convening, bringing people together, is something that's been a part of my entire career. And for me, that's what has made it so exciting.
Yeah, I love that. You know, listening to you reminded me of the book, The Art of Gathering. Have you read that book?
I have read that book, yes.
For any listeners listening, that's a really great book. I feel like after reading it, and by reading it, when I say that, it means that I didn't finish it. It means that I read like maybe halfway.
Well, you don't always have to finish. I didn't read it cover to cover because it's actually a pretty thick book. But the point is to really lean into the main ideas. And so that's really the importance of how do you bring people together in a way that's meaningful and has true and significant impact. And so when I think about my work, I have that opportunity and privilege to be able to do that.
Yes. And I love that. And I hear that from you. And the reason why I'm bringing it up is because after reading it, I feel like how I hosted meetings changed in my work. So for any listeners listening, I definitely recommend it to consider it that way for, you know, professional level, you know, of hosting meetings. Who are you hosting it for? So
great question to ask who you're hosting it for. What is the purpose and intent? And then making sure that everyone who attends that meeting also has an understanding of what the purpose and intent is.
Exactly. I love that. And I love development in that way. Leadership development. And with that, you know, I feel like I'm here today because health and especially health disparities, it's something that I'm aware of, but honestly, I don't discuss on a personal level with those around me. And if we start discussing it in the professional setting as it applies to benefits, as it applies to maybe HR and what we need to keep in mind, or managers, what we need to keep in mind when we are managing teams and supporting humans. And as you said, learn about real human beings or real people. Maybe it can start there. You know, to have that awareness. So that's the intention that I'm bringing to this meeting. And hopefully listeners, this is going to benefit you some way with that awareness piece. So let's go ahead and get started. I wanted to start off with what we're aiming for. And you brought this term up. So I'm going to go ahead and throw it at you, is if you can define what is the optimum level of health.
So the optimum level of health really varies from person to person. And when we talk about health disparities or health care disparities, which are different things, health disparities deal with health outcomes, morbidity or mortality that's connected to certain health outcomes or health chronic disease states, where healthcare disparities focus on access to care, having health insurance coverage, the quality of care that's received. And so these are very complex things, which explain why, you know, we're not talking about it a lot at the dinner table. And another piece of that is around social determinants of health. Those factors where we live, where we play, where we learn, how those all influence our health outcomes. So those are the things that we're most likely to talk about when something is a barrier to me getting the care that I need and looking at those opportunities to learn there. So because of all of these different factors, optimal health varies from person to person. And so, you know, prior to us starting the podcast, we were talking about the whole idea of wellness. And optimal health, in my perspective, is an opportunity to think about whole person care and how wellness shows up in each person's life.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of head nods over here. You know, talking about social determinants of health, I'm curious, I know you started talking about it, but would you mind giving maybe an example of how might that come up? And also, that's one part. The second part is like, what does that mean for the HR leaders and managers who are listening? Like, how does that transfer over to them at the workplace?
Yeah. So social determinants of health, again, are the circumstances in which people are born, where they grow up, where we live, where we work, where we age, and all of those different factors about our environment. And when we think about healthcare and access to healthcare, actually, most of the health outcomes are determined by our physical environment or by social determinants. Again, things that we experience from day to day. About 80% of health outcomes are actually influenced by those factors. So the 20%, that's what happens in the provider's office, for example. It's those 80% of those different factors that we talk about when we're referring to social determinants of health. So what are some examples of social determinants of health? There are six main categories that are usually used. There's around economic stability that looks at factors like, are you employed or not? Are you underemployed? What are your debt? What are medical bills, for instance, you may have to contend with? Then there's the neighborhood and physical environment where you live. Housing is a big social determinant of health. Do you have stable housing? Do you have running water within your home? What about transportation? Are you able to get to a provider's office? How far away from your home is that provider's office? These are things that can create barriers. Are there parks and playgrounds in your neighborhood? When we think about that wellness and that big picture of that whole person health, it's truly that opportunity to examine the opportunities for physical activity outside of the home. Do you live in a walkable community? Then there's things like education, and that looks at overall literacy as well as health literacy. And I'll pause there because when we think about HR and the opportunity to engage employees, helping them understand their employee benefits is key. There's so many studies that indicate time after time that even I don't even know what all of my health benefits are. And I work for a health plan. So we can look for the opportunity to find ways to get that information to our employees, but then also break down that information so they really understand the coverage that they have access to and how they can use that to help ensure, you know, access to the care that they need. So very, very important in terms of the role of HR departments. Another area that's often examined in terms of social determinants of health is around food and food security or food insecurity and having access to healthy options. And when we say healthy, it's really the opportunity to break that terminology down. Foods that have strong or high nutritional value. Are there stores in a person's neighborhood, grocery stores, where they can get fresh vegetables on a regular basis? So assessing that food security or food insecurity is very important. So often we make an assumption that because someone is employed, that food and access to food would not be an issue. But we know also by the number of food banks across our communities that individuals, families are impacted by food insecurity on a regular basis. Then there's the community and safety and social context. And that's looking at everything from having a support system, having people around us who can help guide us and be advocates for us in terms of our health care, knowing where to go in terms of resources in your community. So are you aware of those resources? Do you know where to go to get certain care or get assistance when you need it? Stress also factors into the community and safety and social context. Stress is a huge social determinant of health, something that we all experience in one way or another, but it is a factor that if it's chronic, can have extreme impacts on someone's health. And then the sixth area focuses on the healthcare system, the healthcare ecosystem. Again, looking at things like health coverage, access to providers, and again, bringing in that distance to get to a provider. The quality of care that's delivered. Are your health concerns being met? Are your health concerns being dismissed? If you look at it in the other way, are the treatments that are available being provided and offered for you to get you the care that you need? So I covered a lot of information there, but just to show the breadth of what we have to think about and consider when we're talking about social determinants of health. So I've mentioned health literacy and providing information and access to that information for employees. But what's also key is connecting employees to resources in their community. So I think back to about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, oh my gosh, 4 years ago at the onset of COVID and a focus on employee needs really rose to the top during that first year in particular. And of course, the years after. And there is a big demand to really understand health disparities, because we know by April of 2020, we saw the disparities related to COVID skyrocket, and they were impacting certain communities within our neighborhoods and our states and our cities, and primarily African Americans and Hispanic and Latino communities, as well as the Native communities, were very highly impacted by COVID. But also when we look within our companies and where we work, we know that there was a lot of stress going on because we were dealing in the unknown. A majority of us were working at home and working at home all the time and raising families and being caregivers. So all of these different stressors were in place and impacted people and impacted our employees. So what do we do? So in response to that, we started to focus more on mental health and addressing mental health needs through the workplace. Also a push to connect people to community resources. And so I'm going to circle right back to that. When we think about social determinants of health, it is that opportunity to understand the needs of your employees and then to find the best ways to connect employees to resources to help them meet those needs.
So many great things that you shared there. I personally was connecting a lot with my personal experiences, just listening to you. And I'm sure, and I hope that a lot of the listeners were too. And especially, you know, the theme in my mind that came up was the access and the mode to receiving resources and care. And I love that you ended your response with that of saying like, okay, in the role of manager or HR, how are we contributing to that pathway? How can we further define the pathways that our real people can access care that they need? You know, so I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, an example that I bring up in preparation for the next question, which we will be talking about disparities. So I live in the San Bernardino Mountains. And last year, we had a record-breaking snowstorm. And for us, our local grocery store, the roof fell in. And we had major, major issues when it came to access. As in, my neighborhood street was not plowed for over a week. So that meant that I, an able-bodied younger person, put on my snow gear and I'm like, cool, we're going to go for a hike, you know, like, just try to be positive about it, which I was, you know, maybe that's a double-edged sword there. But I was like, okay, we're going to go to like Goodwin's and we're going to get what we need. Went there. It wasn't collapsed yet, but 3 days later, after we had obtained the resources that we need, and we also went to Ace Hardware to get a new shovel, 3 days after, both buildings had the roof caved in, you know? And it was like, okay, this is apocalyptic. All right. So I'm glad that I have lentils, rice and beans and soup stock. I am somebody who plans ahead with the food security that I am able to have with the time that I was able to prepare, right? And I am able-bodied, right? We have a large community up here who are elderly, who are working on fixed income and who are unable to shovel their driveways, you know? So for me, like it was taking my mind there of like, oh, these are the disparities, not the disparities, the social determinants and the access challenges that I was experiencing at that time, you know, and how the community responded was we now have what's called a Mountain Community Mutual Aid, where they made access to free food, to free wood for those who lost electrical power so that they can have warmth.
Wonderful. Yeah. And so that also, I have a couple of thoughts, and that makes me think about COVID again as well. And the month of March in particular, I remember my last day at work was March the 11th. And I remember leaving, I packed up a few things, didn't realize I needed to pack up a few more things because I would be gone for 3 years, right? But I had the privilege of being able to go home, pack up some stuff and go home with my laptop and work from my desk in my home each and every day. But in that same time, there are individuals who are still getting up, getting dressed and getting out and usually taking public transportation to get to their workplace. And then usually the new terminology you came up with, they were frontline workers. So they were working in the grocery stores or they were working in the hospital setting. And during that March, that first month of March and probably a little part of April, we're still trying to figure out, should we wear a mask for protection or not? And all of the people making that decision were sitting safely in a room with one another. They were nicely protected from others on the outside. They were not on the bus, you know, getting up, getting dressed, getting out, getting on the bus every day without a mask to go to work. And so the policies probably, I would say, were enacted maybe a little slower than they could have been because of just that perspective, that lived experience that they were having versus another individual. And I remember, and it's a very well-known story. In fact, here in Detroit, there's a bus terminal that has just been named after the individual. He was a bus driver, I think about around the age of 50 or close to 50. And he did a video and he posted it on, I think, Facebook it was. And he just talked about how everyday individuals are getting on the bus and they're coughing and they're sneezing and they're coughing and sneezing on him. And I always get a little emotional when I recount the story. Within 2 weeks, he was dead. He was doing his job. He was committed. He was dedicated, but concerned. And he ended up contracting COVID. And then he died from COVID. And we know that COVID was lethal, especially lethal, still lethal, but especially lethal in that first year. And so when we talk about disparities, when we talk about social determinants, it's all of these different kinds of factors. When you reflect on the snowstorm and we have the aging COVID population that may experience some level of disability, but they also may have a need for medication. And so during this time, how do they get access to medication they may need? So all of those things are the kind of different factors we have to think about, ideally in advance and not after, but we do learn from our experiences. And it sounds like your community has developed a really strong action plan for really thinking about the diversity of people and the diversity of needs in your community. And when we talk about things like terminology, we've heard a lot of health equity and health disparities and social determinants of health. It's really that opportunity to understand that one size does not fit all. When we talk about employees, and we think that, well, they're employed here, they're all doing just fine. It's that opportunity to say, well, let me think about that, because one size does not fit all. There might be different reasons and different lived experiences among employees that I might need to think about our benefits coverage or special programs or how we bring healthcare into the setting. Maybe it's a blood pressure check day, or partnering with the American Heart Association to provide information and knowledge. And those are the ways that we can take proactive steps in terms of health disparities and healthcare disparities and addressing social determinants of health.
Hello, listeners. Time for a quick break to give your brain a quick rest. If you have not done so already and would like to support our mission, please follow our podcast, leave a review, or share this episode with someone you think would enjoy it. Thank you so much for listening in, and let's get back to the conversation.
I love this conversation. I do feel that sharing these anecdotes, they shed more light on the specific lived experiences that some people might not have ever experienced or recognize that they may experience, you know? And last thing I'll say that I wanted to share regarding disparities, because you were bringing up COVID. And again, this is with the intention that I hope that sharing would just bring awareness of like, hey, have I thought about that? Have I thought about this person who lives in this city or this demographic and how their access to health resources may be different from mine? Because as somebody who grew up in Orange County, okay? In Southern California, middle class. I now live in San Bernardino County, right? It's different here. And I love living in the mountains. I'm choosing to live in the mountains for my mental health. But during COVID, that first year, we always host Christmas at my grandparents' house. And I'm like, oh, I want to protect them. I'm going to go get tested before. And we were all going to get tested. My brother still lived in Orange County. They were able to get testing fast, you know, paid for it. I went to my local, by the way, I am somebody who does have to commute to get healthcare, which I understand that difference when for me choosing to live in the mountains. And so I went down to my urgent care to get free COVID testing, and everybody else had the same idea as me. And I stood in line for 8 hours to get tested. I'm not kidding. To get tested because I did not want to go to see my grandparents and not know. So it's coming from that place. And you also have to consider, I know for me, a lot of my friends who are Latina were highly impacted by COVID because they tended to be the caregivers. And also the culture, there's a lot of touching and hugging as well as somebody who has been there part of their family, you know, gatherings. And so imagine having to, I'm putting myself in that place of like, okay, I'm the caregiver of somebody older than me. I'm trying to get tested. And now I am standing in this line for 8 hours when I need to think of like, oh, I need to help prepare the food or like, you know, how are we going to teamwork or whatever for the holidays?
But you have to be safe.
Exactly.
So that's number one. But again, there was like, it seemed like one access point in terms of getting the COVID testing. And that was another thing that came up with COVID in particular, testing sites and the location for testing sites. Were we being inclusive? Were we really putting the testing sites initially in neighborhoods and rural communities where people could easily access them? And so that's the key. Everyone's not going to stand in line for 8 hours.
Yes, for sure.
Like back in the day for concert tickets. That's what we used to do for concert tickets.
I'm like, I want to go to Christmas. I need to get tested. I don't want to put my grandparents in this situation and the rest of my family. I'm like too committed sometimes. But yeah, that's what I did. And, you know, I was like, I'm going to go into this holiday with full confidence is where my mind was at, you know? So, you know, I just share that because, again, like not everyone would do that. But that's something some people are choosing to do. Now, that was back in the day, you know, and I bring that up because what we were talking about with social determinants of health, access to community resources, this all impacts the person. How would that impact that person going to work the next day? You know, so I bring that up and I did want to start the conversation on disparities. You mentioned it earlier about the contrast and definition of health disparities and healthcare disparities. So let's go ahead and start there.
So again, one focuses on mortality and morbidity, and that's a healthcare word. So it's about illness and death from illness, and usually with chronic diseases. And then again, health disparities around access to care, how care is utilized, the quality of care. And all of these factors are, again, show up in different ways based on socioeconomic status, gender identity, age, geography. Do you live in a suburban location, rural location, urban? All of these things are factors that come into play. And so there are a lot of statistics out there too, just about the cost of health and healthcare disparities in terms of our healthcare system. And I'm trying to remember it. It's like $1 trillion if we don't get this taken care of right away. And when we think about it, it's truly that opportunity to engage a broad community. So health plans, the nonprofits in the community, grassroots leaders and organizations and communities, employers, again, as I've mentioned in the different ways that they can work to support employees, provide information and education, even advocate with policymakers. And working with our providers, the doctors and the healthcare professionals and our healthcare systems, all of those things come into play. So what are disparities? Something that's been in the news a lot is a focus on maternal health and maternal care and deaths in particular from the maternal journey or birthing process. And when we look at the United States and we rank almost at the bottom in terms of the quality of care that we provide for persons, birthing persons, it's just amazing when you think about it. And what we see based on the statistics is that one, first of all, maternal deaths are increasing in what's called severe maternal morbidities. I don't want to use too much technical jargon, but severe maternal morbidities, things like preeclampsia or high blood pressure that a woman may experience during the birthing, a person may experience through the birthing process. Looking at those kind of factors, sepsis is another example. So it is rising and increasing for everyone in the United States. But then when we look at certain populations like African-Americans and Black women, for example, they are almost 3 times more likely to die from the birthing process, or 2 to 3 times more likely to experience a severe maternal morbidity. And then that's followed by the Native population, as well as Hispanics and Latino women. And so that's a disparity when we see such a prevalent difference in the health outcomes associated with a particular disease state, or in this instance, the birthing process. And so when we look at things we need to do to address those situations, and I'm coming back to the workplace, there are a lot of ways, again, to address this in the workplace. I want to focus on maternal because maternal has been in the news a lot. And the opportunity there, again, when we look at research and studies that have been conducted, it's about understanding the services that are available. When we look at the benefits and opportunities, is there an opportunity to integrate doula coverage as part of your plan coverage, for example, or the use of a midwife? Because the research indicates that extra support, that guidance that a midwife or a doula brings to the birth in person truly makes a difference in their outcomes. And so it's the opportunity to really reflect on that. When we think of diabetes, which of course impacts everyone, but it has a greater impact on Black and African Americans, for example. Heart disease, the same thing. And so we see significant differences in the prevalence rate for those different health states.
Yeah, I love that you're bringing up doulas, actually. That was actually brought up to me. I came across that in the subject that I was consuming as well of doulas, because I feel like I knew what doulas were a long time ago. But then only recently was I like, oh, that sounds beneficial, you know, considering the data.
So what's interesting, I have one child and he is 26. And never at one point, I loosely heard of a doula, just very, very, very loosely. But never at any point was it suggested to me that I should engage with a midwife or a doula to support me in the birthing process or other journey. Back in the day, you don't remember, but there's this really thick book. It's probably about 3 inches thick, and it's called What to Expect When You're Expecting. And so that was the resource that I used if I had a question or I wasn't sure about something. I didn't even know, for example, that if you're having lower back pain, that is a sign that you're near labor. And I did not know that because I just knew my back was killing me. And I was like, I need to lay down. And then that evening, I did go into labor. So doulas can really play a role in just providing information and education and the support. And they have someone to talk to if they're having shortness of breath, and they can understand what that means. Because often, is dismissed, the doula is going to say, no, this is something you should pay attention to. You're not just tired.
I like this team approach that I'm hearing for maternal support, you know, especially, you know, we were talking about this earlier, the benefit of focusing and feeling yourself. And sometimes when you're doing that, if you're pregnant, I assume you might miss some things. So if you have a team that you can connect with that are direct and accessible and welcoming resources, I could see that why that makes sense. And I know you talked about specifically maternal health, but wanted to make sure, are there any other currently common like health or healthcare disparities that you wanted to just put on people's awareness before we move forward?
I mean, they pretty much fall in all areas. It can be kidney disease, diabetes, heart disease. There are disparities when we look at persons with disabilities. They are more likely to experience chronic health diseases at a greater and more prevalent rate. Again, it's the same issues of access to services. There are stories of persons with disabilities who go into practices. Maybe they show up in a wheelchair and the setup of the office cannot appropriately accommodate their needs. So they're not able to get the care that they're looking for and that's required. There was a really fabulous story, I think last year in the New York Times, or at least in the last 2 years, that shared the stories of people who, because they're disabled, they're not able to get the quality of care. We think about members of the LGBTQ plus community, and we see a lot of disparities among those individuals as well. A lot of it is related to stigma, to being rejected when they go to a provider. And when you're rejected, you don't want to go see another provider. So you're not getting the preventative screenings that you need. Also, so all of those different factors come into play in terms of disparities. And when we think about behavioral health, we see disparities there as well. If a member of the LGBTQ plus community is dealing with stigma and the stress and the pressure that results from that, you know, that contributes to a higher rate, behavioral health concerns and disorders as well. And so those are the factors, again, which encourage us of the need to think differently about how we deliver care, how we make care accessible to people, and to remember that one size does not fit all.
I wanted to first say that what you said, it reminded me of when you were talking about the optimum level of health, how it's going to look different for everybody. So I'm kind of like circling back in my brain, hearing that response and going back to what we were discussing earlier. I did want to ask about implicit bias, because I felt like I could hear a little bit of that in your answer as well. So wanted to touch on it. I wanted to ask you, what are a few biases that you wanted to acknowledge today? And also, like, how would you suggest that people handle that? I know that we were talking about, you know, if somebody goes to a healthcare provider and they were rejected, it might be more difficult, or they might feel disencouraged to go to another. So that's just an example, but just curious about what you wanted to share on that point.
Yeah. So I want to make a note, because there are two things that I want to talk about as well. One, to optimal health. And I'll just share my personal story. And basically, I have what could be considered an invisible disability. I'm pretty much functioning right now. And I have an autoimmune condition that I was diagnosed with. And so in my everyday, especially in terms of the infectious diseases that are making their rounds, whether it's COVID or RSV or flu, those are all things that I have to be very careful about exposure to, because it can impact my health. And so for me, my optimal level of health is a necessity that I'm considering all of those things. And what are the things that I put in place? Stress management is another key factor. So I have to be mindful about those things in my everyday living so I can get to my optimal level of health. And so that's just a way of thinking about it. What are the pieces of the social system, the healthcare system, my workplace community that are nurturing and supportive of me in terms of achieving the optimal level of health that I need? So I can be vibrant, so I can show up and be productive, so that I can be a contributing member of my workplace family. So those are the kind of things as well, when we think about it from that whole person-centered perspective. So when we think about unconscious bias, it's truly that opportunity to first understand that all of us as human beings, we all have some level of bias, and it shows up in different ways. And bias comes about just because of the wiring of our brains, and our brains are, most of us all wired the same as far as I know. And so we learn things from what society teaches us, shows us, exposes us to. You know, where we were raised, the family we were raised in, what we see on television, what we see in the movies, what we read in books. Subconsciously, all of these things become captured into how we might think about things and view things. So when we're talking about the concept of kind of being mindful in terms of implicit or unconscious bias, being mindful, it's more than just, you know, meditating. It's not meditating. It's that opportunity to really be conscious and thoughtful about how you're engaging with another human being. And so often, because we're rushing from one thing to the next thing in our everyday, we have shortcuts. And the shortcuts in our brains are those things that we've seen on TV. They're stereotypes that we might learn about by listening to someone we know. Stereotypes that are presented in media like movies, and they become the image of how we think things and people are. So they're there. So when we're rushing and we encounter a situation, we pull on those shortcuts, and usually it's going to show up in a biased way. But when we're mindful, it's that opportunity to slow down, to pause, to be aware. And I always say to lean in and listen to that person in front of you. So now you're going to be able to move to a space of empathy, quite honestly, and then act in the appropriate way based on the individual that you are encountering. And I would say that is so key, because, you know, we like to put people in groups, in boxes, as I call them. But in reality, everyone we throw into one box, they're not exactly the same. Even in that one box, there are differences. And so it's about that ability, again, to just pause and slow down and recognize the biases and how they can show up. So it's important in healthcare Because again, it can show up in terms of weight bias. It can show up in healthcare, how we hire, how we mentor, all of those factors. So it can be based on gender identity and sexual orientation, or it can be around insurance status. It can be around physical ability, as I've mentioned. So all of these factors are places where unconscious bias, unattended bias can show up.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting listening to you. I was thinking how I was connecting the dots on how further important it is for us to continue working on our emotional intelligence, you know, because I think that, and also, you know, not only working on it, but acknowledging emotional intelligence as something worth investing in to develop, because I could see where that plays in with unconscious bias, hence the response that you gave. And nobody's perfect, right? Like, you know, I'm somebody who I feel like naturally I have emotional intelligence, but, you know, that doesn't mean in other areas I'm not lacking. So I was just, that was what came up to my mind. And I wanted to ask with that about advocacy, because I think for those who may be the person that are feeling a little discouraged and unsure how to advocate in different situations, I know that there's so many situations that we can't provide an answer that would fit all, right? So I wanted to get your thoughts on maybe something you've done or something you've seen that's just been assistive with advocacy in a health environment.
Yeah. It's important that one, I've had to advocate for myself. I mean, quite honestly, I had a rheumatologist who every time I went to go see her, she would tell me that I'm just going to get worse and worse. And then when I would come in and ask questions, she would be offended that I'm asking questions about my body, my health, my well-being. And so she definitely wasn't going to be a partner in helping me reach my optimal health. And so basically I had to stand up to her and just what I just said to you, I said, well, this is my body. This is my well-being. And so I'm going to ask questions and I'm not going to shy away from asking those questions. And in some instances, there may be individuals who will shut down because of that and not ask questions. And we have to be courageous enough to speak up for ourselves. And if we can't do it, bring someone to the doctor's office who can do it for you, because you know your body best and you are the person who's the expert on your body. And so I would encourage those actions. If it's helpful to have a list, take a list with you to the doctor's office and ask those questions. Do not allow anyone to prevent you from asking those questions. And if they don't want to answer the questions, find a new physician or find a new healthcare provider who will ask those questions. And so that's really key. You know, it was during COVID, so I had to stick it out with her for a couple of years because it was not easy to find a new physician during the pandemic. But I did. I asked her a question. I said, you keep telling me I'm going to get worse and worse and I'm getting better and better. Can we talk about that? So ultimately, it was an opportunity for me to find a new physician who wanted to be a partner, who wanted to be on my team, and who wanted to support me in a way that's going to lead to my optimal health.
I love that. Okay. Two things I wanted to share is it's bringing me back to when we were talking about a doula. Okay. Because the doula can advocate for that person. And also, I didn't realize that I attended a health situation with somebody that I know. And that person had, it was an impacted center that we had went to. We went to an urgent care plus that was also like an emergency room. And at the same time, like it was close by. So there was like triaging going on. It was impacted. It was overcrowded. So that means that the person that I was with was waiting for hours to be seen and hungry, concerned. Okay. We were met finally by the, I think it was a nurse practitioner. I'm not sure. Somebody, the provider. And the provider said, I understand that you're anxious, and told the person that he's anxious and said it multiple times, but it felt minimizing. It felt like because the person I was with was advocating for additional services or to be referred, to specialists post, you know? And so the person was like, oh, they're not going to find anything. You're just anxious.
Mm-hmm. It's dismissing it, dismissing the concern. Oh, you're fine. Go back home. It's not a concern. Oh, you're anxious. That's all it is.
Yes, exactly. Me putting my empath hat on, I was like, okay, this provider is probably overwhelmed with how many people that he's seeing. And this person is probably trying to use this language to make this, my friend, feel like it's not a big deal not to worry. However, it's coming off not that way. I was there, and you know, the person I was with was overwhelmed. And when that happens, people can shut down or blow up. This person would shut down. So then I advocated and I said, no, he's not anxious. And we're just trying to get the documentation so we can get a referral, is what I said. And then so that provider, I think, woke him up a little bit and was like, wait, what am I doing? And so I felt a pause happen for that provider. The provider finished the communication, left, and we were seen by different providers after that. So kind of interesting. But the reason why I bring that up is because, to hence your point, it's totally understandable why you would go seek care, not alone, if you can. And I want to normalize that because I think that could be beneficial depending on who you choose to bring with you. But, so that's something I wanted to bring to the table. And, you know, it's making me think of like, oh, when I go to see the doctor, I like to be very independent, but maybe I should consider bringing somebody with me, like if I'm feeling uncomfortable.
Exactly. And also depending on exactly what you're dealing with. If it's a lot of information, if it's news that might be a little disturbing for you, it's good to have that support. And also someone who can hear the treatment options that may be needed, and they can discuss that with you so you can make sure you didn't miss anything. So, and there are so many great physicians, I do want to add, out there to partner with who are concerned about your healthcare. In advocating for ourselves, we owe it to ourselves to find those physicians who are ready to pause, ready to listen, and ready to partner with us in terms of our healthcare.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And to that point, I did want to plug from the client to provider relationship. When I sought out my PCP, I was looking them up on some access resources. Like, oh, okay, this person has good reviews. Yeah, I think let's try it. And this person's a nurse practitioner. And I've also seen other people like, oh, I want to see an actual doctor, not a nurse practitioner. I was like, wait, what does that mean? I'm like, I don't understand. So I came anyways, because I saw that this person had good reviews and I just wanted somebody who would be nice to me and care. And I went and the person was amazing. So I want to just give a plug for nurse practitioners out there. Like, I honestly haven't had a better PCP than this person.
I'd second that on the nurse practitioner. Fantastic. Just the time, the listening, and the compassion. Amazing. I have a nurse practitioner as well, and fantastic.
Good. Yeah. I wanted to plug that on that side because, like, I want to, you know, lift people up too on the healthcare provider side, not just considering the client receiving side. So appreciate that. Okay. Any resources that you want to shout out for our listeners to check out?
I would say some of the national healthcare organizations like the American Heart Association, the American Diabetes Association, the March of Dimes. You can even go to the cdc.org website. I think it's .org. Just lots of information about disparities, about understanding disparities, but most important about prevention and things you need to know in terms of getting to and moving to your optimal health. So when we think about the AHA, the American Heart Association, for example, they have this thing called Know Your Scores. So know your cholesterol levels, know your blood pressure. Know these things on a regular basis and monitor them. Because in reality, it's the simple things we do that makes a difference in getting to that place of our own optimal health. So if we're doing that physical activity, we're looking at ways to reduce ultra-processed foods and add more vegetables to our everyday meal consumption. And we're getting those screenings like our preventative screening, as well as choline screening, that you get starting at age 45 plus, a little earlier if you have history in your family. Breast exam screenings that women are encouraged to do on a monthly basis, as well as the mammogram starting at, I think it's 40. So taking the opportunity to see your nurse practitioner on an annual basis just to get your checkup. And what we are seeing is that people younger and younger are being diagnosed with cancer. So as a society, it's something we really need to pay attention to and think about, what do we need to do differently for ourselves, for our family, for our communities, to kind of change this trend that we're seeing.
I love how thoughtful your responses are. Okay, switching gears to the workplace side. What would be three pieces of advice that you would give leaders when it comes to considering their employee health and where it meets the workplace?
I would say one, maybe conduct a survey to understand what's top of mind for your employees and then look at ways you can provide information regarding those top of mind concerns. Behavioral health, of course, is very important because we know that in our workplace communities now, we are bringing so much to our workplace. It's where we spend most of our time, right? But when we look out our windows, we look at the news, there's just so much going on in our world, and it's impacting us in so many different ways. So behavioral health and providing access and tools to manage stress, to just deal with the ambiguity that we're all experiencing right now is also very beneficial. And then look at fun ways where you can bring health and wellness into the workplace. Maybe there is a opportunity to focus on, do some kind of gaming initiative around measuring blood pressure over a 3-month time period or something. You know, have fun with it, but it's also something that's a very good indicator of overall health.
Love that. Okay, our last question for today. What does an inclusive workplace look like to you?
So that's my favorite topic. An inclusive workplace is really a workplace that, one, understands that diversity is way more than race and that there are many dimensions of diversity. It can be being an introvert, like I'm an introvert. So that's a dimension of diversity. And I had an aha moment that I learned that a lot of people who are introverts feel excluded in the workplace. So that became a new focus of mine. I talk about it all the time. But just recognizing that there's race, there's gender, there's sexual orientation. But beyond that, there are things about our lived experiences and who we are and whether we're a single parent and whether we're a caregiver. All of these things become a part of the diversity. So recognizing that. And once we recognize that, we move to that place of inclusion where we're able to come together. And as I always say, learn about different cultures, communities, generations, work styles, and perspectives. And doing it in a way that we create an understanding, that we recognize both similarities and differences, that we take the opportunity to really lean in. And as a result of that, we're showing respect. And that's really the key. An inclusive environment or an inclusive workplace community is one where we can share and show respect for the people around us. And I really love when I think about it and I pause and this was last year, the years go by so fast. An employee sent me an email and every year at the beginning of the year, I kick off with a learning session based on one of our campaigns. And it was about a week or so after this initial learning session. And she says, well, I'm reaching out just to say that, one, I notice everything that you're doing for the LGBTQ+ community. She shared that. She said, I am a transgender woman and I feel safe here and I feel like I can contribute. And when I think about an inclusive workplace community, I think about outcomes like that, where someone feels psychologically safe and they feel it and they can articulate it. And I know when we think about the LGBTQ+ community, there are so many different perspectives, but I always beg the question, how does showing respect for and towards another human being change what you believe? And if we can answer that question, we can get to having an inclusive environment.
I love that. I wanted to let that breathe because it was such a great response. I did want to say that I feel like the theme that I hear in a lot of the responses and conversations and discussions we've had today, what I really appreciate is the contextual level of respect and learning about real people that you've given today. Because I think, you know, what you were saying, diversity is not just race. And you're talking about work styles and perspectives. And I think the more we focus on teaching about the context behind these different issues, the better. So I thank you so much for being here and being part of that. And hopefully we spread some seeds today to help bring awareness to things, to help, you know, further equip the leaders and people and allies and co-conspirators, whatever you want to call those who want to make things better. So thank you for that is what I want to say.
No, thank you. Thank you. It's just been a wonderful conversation and very glad to shed some light a little bit on all these things related to health. And it's really about well-being and how we show up as people and as human beings.
Thank you for joining us today as we continue to explore how we can enable diversity at work. Follow us and get notified of our latest episodes. Also, we want to hear from you. Please like, rate, and review us on your podcast app or wherever you're listening in. If you want to contact us, please visit diverseek.com. That is diverseek.com. This episode was produced by Madhu Nair, edited by Jonathan Dalek, researched by Jolene May, music composed by Nicholas Lang, and our production team includes Keisha Williams, Prashant Falbar, and Maria Quirina. I am your host, Jolene May, and you have been listening to Diverseek.